On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory common ownership development. It is broadcast live from WEBR Fairfax, Virginia. Join us as we explore the world of common ownership development, the fastest growing form of residential development in America today. This housing concept includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes that are part of a mandatory homeowners association. Unfortunately, this type of housing is not as utopian as its advocates would have us believe. Living in a mandatory homeowners association means giving up part of the American dream. It means giving up constitutional rights and control over one's most valuable asset, one's home. Living in a mandatory homeowners association means leaving the American zone. WEBR Fairfax Radio, I'm Sue Bartholomew, you're on the Commons. And on the Commons with me today is one of my favorite guests, Barry Silver. Barry, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here, and you're one of my favorite hosts.
Oh, thank you.
Try to bring common sense to the world, which is sorely lacking these days.
Well, listen, I have been jumping for joy ever since I heard that you got a little help with a case that you've been on to talk about before.
And yeah, we did get a little help.
And that's nice.
Yeah, George Andres, who's been flying his flag in defiance of the Homeowners Association, has now been given assistance by the three branches of state government. First, the governor personally visited his home, took a flag from the Capitol, and put it up himself on the offending flagpole, and himself raised the flag on the flagpole to show solidarity, and handed George a check for $100 saying, I hear that you've been fined $100 a day. This will cover today's fine. So he got support from the executive branch. Then he got support from the legislative branch when they passed the law, specifically with his name, on the legislative history of the law. They passed it because of him, and they made it retroactive in effect so that it was designed to protect him from these fines. And then he got assistance recently from the judicial branch. The top legal officer in the state of Florida, the Attorney General, intervened on his behalf, and now has helped come to his rescue. So we've got a lot of assistance from all three branches of state government.
Is that an unprecedented situation or what?
Yeah, it definitely is. I've never heard of such a thing where they actually pass a law to help somebody out, and then the governor and attorney general all come to help. And what's remarkable about it is that the association still hasn't backed off, even with three branches of government against them, public opinion against them, the people who live in the community embarrassed about what's going on. They still are undeterred.
I'm sure there's no one left in the country who doesn't know George Andres, but let's give a very brief history and outline of what happened and how we got here.
Okay. George Andres lives in Jupiter, and he's a Marine veteran. And he believes very strongly in flying the flag. So when he came to his community, he brought his flag with him and put it up on the flagpole, as is the normal way of flying flags according to the federal codes. And he went to the board that was in power at the time and said, I've got this flag and flagpole. Do I need to get your written approval for this? And they said, don't be silly. The flag. You don't need to get approval. There's nothing in the rules that would prohibit somebody from flying a flag. Of course he can fly the flag, and so he did. And, in fact, he even served on the board for a little while. And then apparently a new board came in, and the woman in charge had a personality clash with George, I think because she's a little on the autocratic side, and he likes doing things by consensus, and I think he asked one question too many. So she decided that she was going to have it in for him. So the first thing she did was she said, hey, what's that flag doing there? He said, I got permission. She said, you didn't get permission from me. He said, I didn't think I needed your permission. The other board said I didn't. She said, well, I'm telling you, you do. Take down the flag and take down the flagpole. And back and forth correspondence went for a while, and then he refused to take down the flag, and so she sued him. Now, all of this happened before I even knew who George Andres was. Unfortunately, he lost in the trial level. Some judge felt that the rules of the association were binding upon George and covered the flag. What most people don't know, which is really outrageous, is that the president who was going after George came up with some ridiculous rule. Article 13, it says, you may not alter the exterior of your unit. You can't alter the exterior of your lot. So she was desperately looking for some rule that would cover flags, so that's the one that she seized upon. You can't alter the exterior of your lot. So what's really amazing that nobody really picks up on is the fact that she wrote a letter to her attorney before she started the litigation, trying to get the attorney to give an opinion that would back up her crazy interpretation of the rule. And she says in the letter, "Dear Mr. Attorney, we're trying to figure out how to interpret Article 13. It says exterior to your lot. Does that mean that it covers only things that are actually on the building itself? Or would this rule cover things that are actually on somebody's lawn?" So then the letter comes back in some kind of double talk. It's rather unclear, and it gives all these different scenarios, but from the response, you can't really tell what it covers. But the main point is that the president said in a letter to the attorney, she was trying to get clarification because she couldn't figure it out. By the way, what's the exterior of a lot? If it actually applied to the lawn, why would it say the exterior of the lot? Obviously, it's talking about the exterior as part of a building.
So that would...
there's no such thing as the exterior of a lot. It makes no sense. But she went into court and told the judge that this rule that she couldn't understand, she said, is perfectly clear. George Andres understood it when he came in here. He knew exactly what the rule meant. It meant that he couldn't fly a flag. So she testified in court that George clearly knew this, even though she didn't. And she's worked for attorneys who do property law for about 20 years. So she doesn't know. The attorney doesn't know. But she lies to the court and says that George knew. So the judge ruled against him. He appealed it, and the appellate court affirmed. And then after it looked hopeless, then he came to me, because I'm usually the attorney of last resort. And then he asked if there was anything I could do, and we've been trying to undo that ever since. But it's like a runaway train. These judges just look and say, hey, there's a judgment against him. He lost. It's too late. I can't do anything about it. Sorry.
But
so even though all these high officials in the state government have supported him, the judges are basically saying it's too late. But we have had recently new developments that seem to be turning things around, and I think the tide is now turning in George's favor.
Well, I think it's been very, very exciting to sit back here and watch this because, as you know, there have been a number of flaps across the country from one end of the country to the other, and they've... And you know what's interesting, Barry, is that none of them seem to have specific language in their documents to say that you cannot fly the flag from a flagpole. They all rely on ambiguous mumbo-jumbo legalese like alter the exterior.
Right.
It's an unapproved structure. It's a lawn ornament. It's a visual nuisance. And the judges are buying this. What's wrong with them?
Well, the thing that a lot of people don't realize is that it's a general principle of contract interpretation that if a clause is ambiguous, you interpret it against the person who wrote it.
That's right.
So the association has these ambiguous documents. They shouldn't be able to get away with saying that it covers certain things, because if you're going to tell someone that they're sacrificing basic fundamental rights and that they can't do something, you better explain it very clearly. Otherwise, you have no business telling them that they waive the right if it's ambiguous. That's very clear in the law. And that's why usually the association shouldn't be able to get away with it. But politics and other factors often come into play. And a lot of times you just have judges who side with associations because they have a lot more political power than some lone individual. And if they want to stay in office, they tend to go with the more powerful entity. So unfortunately, that's what enters into it.
So there is no justice. Is that what you're saying, basically, bottom line?
That really is a fundamental lesson from this case and others. It's kind of like, I know you're covering condo and homeowners associations, which is a very important issue because I care very deeply about that. But that is part of the entire legal system as a whole, which in general, in my opinion, focuses little or no attention on justice and instead focuses all its attention on the law. And when that happens, you have some very horrific consequences to society in general. To have a legal system which doesn't care about justice is just flat out wrong. And in fact, I was looking over some things from the Florida Bar, and the motto for the Florida Bar is law and justice. A lot of judges don't realize that, and they just carry out the law. You know, they have laws in the old Soviet Union. They had laws in effect in Iraq. They have laws in a lot of very repressive regimes. And if all you're concerned about is the law, and you have no concern whatsoever for justice or compassion or common sense, then it's going to be a very, very scary legal system. Now, our system is a lot better than a lot of other ones. And fortunately, we don't have crazy, maniacal, homicidal dictators in power. But we do have some amount of injustice that goes on and some very cruel things that can happen in our legal system when all you look at is the law.
But Barry, didn't you just say in the law that restrictive covenants are usually construed in favor of the weaker party? And it's not, but they're not even following the law. They're basically saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, you agreed to just give up all your rights, and nobody's done that.
Yeah, well, the courts usually feel that when you move into an association, you're bound by all these rules. Then it's up to the judge to make a determination on what the rules are saying. And very often, the interpretation of the judge doesn't make any sense at all. They just give their impression, and whatever it is, so be it. And a lot of times you have some really crazy results, unfortunately, as a consequence.
Well, I think, I never thought of it this way, but you said in George's case, he got help from all three branches of the government, the executive, legislative, and judicial. I mean, what kind of a message is that sending to the judge?
Well,
or should it send to the judge, and should it send to those who sort of make a living off associations?
Yeah, the judge really hasn't seemed to be too influenced by anything going on around her. In other words, the fact that we've been attacked, the fact that people are flying flags now, the fact that we're encouraging people to show their patriotism, the fact that the ruling is unjust, all of that seems to have no impact whatsoever. And another major factor about all of this, which often gets lost, but I don't understand how any judge could overlook this, is the big picture. The big picture is that after George lost his case and the judge ruled that he had to take down his flag, I got involved and I filed another separate, independent cause of action. And it was based on a new law that was passed by the legislature. And I asked the court to guarantee through injunction his right to fly the flag on a flagpole. And we obtained a temporary injunction. And so right now he is flying his flag on a flagpole by an injunction that was entered by a judge. And so the courts usually try to figure out who prevailed by looking at who got what they were trying to accomplish by the litigation. The association was trying to get George to take his flag down from this flagpole. They failed miserably. He never took the flag down. They got a judgment, but the flag never came down. And now all three branches have sided with him, and the court sided with him. And even the association is now backed off, and they're not even trying to stop him from flying the flag on a flagpole. So by any standard of common sense, he prevailed. And to say that even though he prevailed, he now has to pay out $28,000 and can lose his home is so outrageous. But in the court system, there very often is a complete lack of common sense or compassion. And this is a very good example of that.
Well, that's one of the things that's been puzzling me, because I look at this and I see, okay, so everybody's back down. He's got the right to fly a flag on a flagpole on his own private property. And yet they still, and he prevailed, and yet they still want him to pay the legal costs? I mean, the association lost, right?
Yeah, that's right. Doesn't make any sense. Except what the association is claiming is there was already a valid judgment. It was already entered. He appealed and he lost, and there was a judgment saying that he owes the association X amount of money.
What
and
about
so regardless of what happened afterwards, that judgment is still valid and was never overturned. Therefore, he should pay the money. That's the association's argument.
And what about the courts? This is where they... Okay, now, George's house was supposed to go on the auction block, what, 2 weeks ago?
Yeah, a couple of weeks ago. And then a couple of days before, the judge agreed with us and said that it was protected by homestead. By the way, there's a lot of legal stuff that I still have that's brewing right now based on the new case that we filed to try to get a permanent injunction to get attorney's fees and to get attorney's fees on the foreclosure action, which should hopefully offset the amount of money that he owes the association. So I'm hoping that that's going to play out well. So there's a lot of things still brewing. But yes, you're correct. He was a couple of days away from losing his home.
Can you give us a nutshell of what the Homestead Act or exemption means?
Sure. The homestead exemption is contained in Florida's Constitution and the constitutions, the federal constitution and the constitutions of most, if not all, states. What it says is that if people have judgments against them, then the creditor should not be able to take their home away in order to receive the compensation that they're due from that judgment. It's a homestead protection saying a person's home is sacrosanct, and you can't take a guy's house away in order to collect a debt. And the reason why the state does that probably is not so much based on compassion toward the individual. It's not like they feel sorry for the individual. It's that they're worried about the state coffers. Because if people had their homes taken away from them, they would become destitute and homeless, and then the state would end up having to pick up the tab to provide some kind of shelter for these folks. Well, you'd have a lot of homeless people running around. So the state doesn't want to have to become the ward for these people because it's going to cost them a lot of money, so they pass the homestead exemption. And it also applies in other contexts as well. There's a lot of, in a lot of different areas, the home is protected from being taken away.
Are there any exemptions, for instance, if somebody didn't pay their taxes?
The exemptions tend to be if somebody did work on the home, then they can perhaps put a lien on it and take it. So, for instance, if somebody does electrical work or plumbing work on a home, and or they construct a home, and they're owed money, and the work they did was actually on that house itself, then they can sometimes levy on the home. Or, for instance, a bank gives somebody a lot of money to buy the house, so their security interest is in the home. Then they can get around the homestead exemption. Now, what the association in this case was arguing is that when the Andreses moved in, they signed, in addition to all the other stuff, they agreed that if the association ever got a judgment against the Andreses, they agreed to waive homestead exemption. They claimed that the Andreses waived this important constitutional right and allowed the association to take their house away if they got a judgment against them. Now, the documents are not real clear on this, in our opinion, and what the Attorney General and I argued is that it says only certain things can lead to a foreclosure on the home. They didn't waive the homestead exemption for all purposes. For instance, if they had to pay assessments on the house, you know, like everybody has to pay maintenance, and that's the maintenance fees are designed to improve the quality of the home itself or the surrounding area, then if they didn't pay maintenance fees, then they might be able to take the house, and you might argue that they waived homestead. But these fees, attorney's fees and fines, that wasn't covered in the documents. And unless it's specifically covered in the documents, then you can't say that somebody waived this very important constitutional right. And an interesting wrinkle is that when all this was happening and their house was being threatened, I had my appendix burst. And so I taken off to the hospital. I was there for a week, and I was pretty out of it for a little while. So the Attorney General happened to step in at a very important time because the house was going to be sold, and I wasn't really in any shape to do a whole lot about it. So I filed a motion with the help from my secretary and the Attorney General, and I put my name on it, and then the Attorney General intervened and actually came into court and argued it. And I was there, but I hadn't been able to do the research and stuff, and the Attorney General argued it. I kind of watched and I made some comments, and Attorney General did a great job, and the judge agreed with the arguments by the Attorney General.
How did that feel, Barry, to sit there in court and have the Attorney General on your side?
It was pretty wild because I'm always going against the state. In fact, at the moment, I have, I think, three different cases against the state of Florida in which the Attorney General is litigating against me. So it's very bizarre for me. I'm usually fighting against the state of Florida, and I'm suing the state and the county and the city and going up against the bureaucracy. And to have the Attorney General on my side, it made me a little nervous. I'm thinking, wait a minute, am I doing the right thing here?
Which side am I?
It was a lot of fun. They're really good. They got a lot of resources. And the people that were there were very, very friendly, very nice to work with. And it was pretty exciting being on the same side with the Attorney General. Although I think I like arguing against them more.
Yeah, that's more fun, huh?
Yeah.
Being the rebel. We've got a lot in common here.
But we have the Choose Life license plate that was pushed on us by the fundamentalists.
Uh-huh.
And I have a lawsuit against that. And the Attorney General's on the other side of that lawsuit. That's a pretty interesting case to me. So I'm having a good time with that one. But George's case certainly is fascinating. And what a wonderful person he is and his wife, and very courageous. And I feel really privileged to be able to represent people like that who will really fight for their convictions and who aren't intimidated by the bureaucracy. It's a wonderful experience to represent folks like that.
Well, he sort of came on and said, I don't care what you do, I'm not taking that flagpole down. And there it looked for a while that he'd won the right to keep the flagpole and the flag flying, but then he was going to lose his home. And so what kind of a victory was that when all was said?
I think they called it a Pyrrhic victory.
and then now this. Is this a once-in-a-lifetime experience, do you think, having the Attorney General step in and help you with a case?
Well, it probably is for George. I imagine that he's not going to have too many other cases that are like this one. So this will probably be a once-in-a-lifetime experience.
How about you?
I've had quite a few different cases where I've been involved with the governor and the attorney general and the legislature. I tend to do things like that fairly often. But where I'm actually litigating with the attorney general probably won't happen too often. I do actually have a couple of other cases, though, where I think the attorney general is going to be interested, that I'm going to try to get them involved in some cases. But I'm going to wait until this is over because I don't want to push my luck. I have a case where a couple of psychics were ripping off people of their life savings to the tune of millions of dollars, and the city of Del Rey was just allowing them to operate and covering for them and not alerting people and actually protecting these folks so that they can continue to prey on people. And it's really an economic crime, and the Attorney General's office specializes in that, and it's a really outrageous situation where people were horribly victimized. Elderly people take $400,000, all their life savings gone. I think the Attorney General might be interested in this one, so I'm going to see if they want to get involved.
Well, I understand that the Attorney General, Charlie Crist, is sort of very pro-consumer, anti-fraud.
Yes, I think he is, and I saw him at a meeting the other day, and he was speaking, and he and I are on opposite sides of the political divide.
Mm-hmm.
He's quite conservative, and I'm quite liberal on most issues. But I did get up, and I said, I feel very proud that we have an attorney general who brings a moral tone to the office and who is concerned about bringing justice to the legal system. And I believe that very strongly. His understanding of what justice is in certain cases may differ than mine, but he certainly believes strongly in bringing morality and justice and ethics to the legal profession and to his office. And that, he and I are very, I feel very good about having him there, and I think that he's doing a good job in that regard. I want to have a chat with him about some of the issues, though. But I like to work with him. I think he's doing a really good job. I like him.
Well, you know, Barry, people across the country get so frustrated because they call the Attorney General. They're having these unspeakable problems with their associations. And the Attorney Generals basically wash their hands and say, well, you know, we really can't get involved. That's a civil matter. Hire an attorney, go to court, and we just will not get involved. We won't get our hands in that one. But yet here you've got an attorney general who seems to roll up his sleeves and jump in there with you. I mean, this is something that's just not, you know, goes against what he believes in, I presume.
You're right. Very, very unusual, and I hope he continues to do that. He's fairly new in office, but I think he's making wonderful use of his office in doing this, and I hope he'll continue to do that and set an example for other attorney generals throughout the country.
You used to be an elected representative, right?
Right. I was in the Florida legislature.
So you've got some experience on how the political side of all of this works.
I mean, I have a lot of experience about how the political side works.
And you're sort of, you told me, because the first time you came on, you had a song that you had written for George. And when I talked to you a couple of days ago and invited you to come on, I asked you if you were going to sing. You told me that you had another case and that you had also written a song for them and that you wanted to share that with my listeners.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll be glad to do George's song again.
Go for it.
All right. Thank you. It's a band old flag, it's a contraband flag at the Indian Creek Association. Don't even try to let it fly, or they will commence litigation. Don't fly the red, white, and blue, or they'll come after you. And believe me, it is no brag. So if you live at Indian Spring, be sure not to fly your flag.
Bravo! The singing attorney, I love it.
Except I said Indian Springs instead of Creek. That's Indian Springs where I play tennis.
Oh, okay.
I get mixed up sometimes. Then I have another case where I'm litigating for all the people in Palm Beach County whose citrus trees are being eradicated by the government because, in my opinion, the legislature was paid off by the citrus industry to wipe out the competition. But they claim that they're nervous about a disease called citrus canker. So I wrote a little song about that. I'll just give you the first verse if I can remember it.
Okay.
Why do you want to cut down my old citrus tree? It's not hurting you, and it's canker-free. I need its tender fruit to feed my family. So forget about us, take off those handcuffs, and I will jump for glee if I don't see a chainsaw around my old citrus tree.
Oh, I love it. That's perfect, and it's really timely right now.
Yeah, thank you very much. I have a lot of songs for many different occasions that I sing around the town. And my name's Barry, so people say, what's your voice range? I say, I sing in a baritone. Oh, now I have a little son now, Ari, who's 16 months old. And I wrote a little verse for him also. It goes, rock-a-bye, Ari, on the treetop. When the state comes, your tree they will chop. When the law breaks, your citrus trees fall. Down comes our Constitution, civil rights and all.
I love it. I mean, you know, you have to get the point across and you have to have fun doing it.
Yeah, I agree with you. You got to have a good time in whatever you're doing. If you take it too seriously, sometimes it can be very demoralizing.
I
fight as hard as I can, and I put in a lot of time on it, but I also try to have a good time while I'm at it.
On behalf of all of us, Barry, across the country, I want to thank you for your role in helping George Andrus with the flag issue.
Well, thank you very much, and I want to thank you for trying to help improve the situation, because I agree with you 100%. What happens with homeowners and condo associations is really sad. And if we don't bring justice and ethics and morality and common sense to the legal system, we're all in trouble. And I congratulate you for trying to help do that and to use the airwaves for that purpose.
Well, thank you, but I don't have the three branches of government egging me on. You do.
No, but you're the fourth branch of government, so you're just as important. So keep up the great work.
Thank you, and thanks a lot, Barry.
Take care, Shane.
Take care. Bye. Okay, guys, don't go away. We'll be right back. With coming up next will be Jan Bergman, and he'll be talking to us about not moving to fraud-friendly Florida. So don't go away. We'll be back.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. they're full of woes. No pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.
WEBR Fairfax Radio. I'm Shu Bartholomew. You're on the Commons. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions. Joining me on the Commons during the second half, we're still in Florida, but this time we have Jan Bergman. Jan is president of Cyber Citizens for Justice, which is a Florida-based organization, grassroots organization. Thank you for joining me, Jan.
Hi, Shu. Nice talking to you, and welcome to fraud-friendly Florida.
Well, thank you, except that I'm up here in fraud-friendly Virginia.
Yeah, well, so we minimum have something in common in that case. But, you know, I would like to tell you a little bit why we called it in our new slogan, fraud-friendly Florida. As you know, and as we have told everybody, since years, we are trying to enact reforms for mandated properties here in Florida. But, wisdom escapes me. Our legislators are not willing to do anything about it, despite all the horror stories you can hear and read every day in the paper. And I know you just talked with Barry about the case in Jupiter with the flagman. And
that's right.
I mean, that is just one example of many. Our governor had created the Destination Florida Commission. And amazingly enough, they decided something needs to be done to get more retirees here to Florida because it is income source number two for the state. But instead of checking out that they create some quality, that's why they lost the number one spot in the nation, they decided to go for quantity over quality, and here we are.
So what you're saying is they're trying to get people to actually move to Florida.
Yes. Well, they realize since they lost the number one spot in the nation, you know, in former times, Florida was always the number one for retirees to move to after their retirement. Florida is not number one anymore, and our economy realized that, and now they're trying to do something. But despite many warnings, they're unwilling to create some better quality. And missing quality is what created the problem in the first place, because people don't want to move to a state where they know consumers are not protected. But nobody here is willing to protect them. They just want to get them down here, get the money, and then what the heck?
I know you can give me an example, so I'm not even going to pretend to go there with that one. But let's just talk a little bit about the work that you've been doing. And you tried very hard for the last couple of years to try and get some kind of a task force to look into homeowners associations. Is that right?
Yes, that is right. I really have a hard time understanding you.
I'm sorry. Is this better?
Not really.
How about now?
Now is better.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I understood what you said. Yes, we're trying to do a lot about reforming the association law.
Now, we have, I mean, there's some real horror stories across the country, not just in Florida. We hear from people from, you know, New York down to Florida and from Virginia out to California and Idaho and even some of the Midwestern towns where you'd think that nobody would be living in these things, but they are.
Well, the thing is, here in Florida, what other choice do you have? If you move here and want to build a home, there are more or less no lots available outside any homeowners association. And so what do you want to do? If you want to move here, you're forced to move into one. Despite better knowledge sometimes, But, you know, with no choice, what is left?
You know, there are a lot of associations in Florida that are defunct. That, although there is the underlying mechanism there, there's just nobody on the board, nobody's collecting the money, and there's no need to because there's really no common area. And, yeah, but you're right. They're mandated. The local municipal governments love them because they can collect taxes and they don't have to do anything in return for the taxes. But beyond that, I mean, that's a basic injustice. What George Andrus has been through is yet another injustice. But there's another one that I think is a real horror story, Eagle's Landing. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
What? I think that is, in the moment, the horror story number one in Florida. It's the story of about 180 homeowners who moved to a homeowners association in Pinellas County in Florida. The name of the association is Nature Watch. And, well, these people moved there to live there happily ever after and thought they're buying nice houses and everything is happy and nice. They had a functioning homeowners association. Everybody paid the dues and everybody did what they were supposed to do until some homeowners found construction defects in their home. And instead of repairing them and doing something about it, they came up with the idea that their neighbors are supposedly paying for these repairs, and because it's an association deal, they claim, and so did one of the attorneys. And while everybody in the beginning laughed about it, and because I mean, we live in a society where everybody expects everybody else to pay for the problems, but it's still. We thought it is that far that you have to pay for the repairs of your neighbor's home. But the attorney who came up with the idea found a sympathetic judge, and the judge, in all his wisdom, decided that all the neighbors living in the association are supposed to pay for these repairs. And,
Jan, I'm sorry.
Set up a receiver, got rid of the actual association board, and now the receiver is doing whatever he feels like doing and is creating, obviously, according to what I heard, huge bills with the help of the attorneys.
Jan, let's give our listeners your web address because they can go to your web address and they can read the story about this actual horror story. There are some very graphic pictures. There's a picture of a guy holding a board of wood, and he can actually look through it.
Yes.
That was taken down. And you want to give them your web address?
Oh, the web address is real easy. It's www.ccfj.net. And from there, you can find all the buttons. And if you go to Florida Homeowners Association articles, you find a long, long list of what we call horror stories. And it will show you that what we are saying is all along true.
Jan, there are about 182 houses, units in this association.
Yes.
And you had said that about 120 of them risk foreclosure?
Right. Well, the receiver decided that he needs everybody to pay $93,000. I mean, that is about the same amount some of the people paid for their home initially.
So this is a special assessment. This is a special assessment.
These people don't have that money.
It's a special assessment of $93,000. Am I correct?
Yes, you're absolutely correct. I mean, they didn't expect you to pay it all from one day to the other, but as far as it looks now, it will be spread over 8 months.
8 months. You've got 8 months to come up with $93,000.
Yes.
Now, Jan, let me ask you, does this include the $24,000 they've already paid, or is this in addition to?
Well, that includes the $24,000 or the $28,000 they already paid, yes.
Okay, so they want another $64,000.
Yes.
In the next 8 months.
Right. And then don't forget, the receiver wants to be paid, so do the attorneys, who are all making a nice good buck out of that one, and are definitely happy to have found that kind of employment. And, with other words, everybody is getting rich but the homeowners, and as you have heard, some of them already took their belongings, left, and left their houses sitting there. They just didn't want to deal with the problem any longer.
So they walked away from it.
They just walked away from
it. Now, these are people who have paid their assessments. They're not delinquent.
No, they have paid everything from taxes to mortgages to homeowners association dues, everything they were expected to pay, plus, in the meanwhile, $28,000 in a special assessment.
And now
they're
walking away.
They're asked to pay another $63,000 in assessment, and that's a little bit more than most people have in their pocket this change.
Now, if you do something personally and you screw up and you get yourself into debt and you can't get out, that's your problem. But what do you think of this notion that you can be liable for somebody else's screw up?
Well, honestly, before I didn't read the document, I first received information about this case by email. Then I talked to a few people on the phone. And believe me, I didn't believe them. I thought they were kidding me. And then one of them said, hey, you know, I have it all in writing. So he copied me a lot of the court documents, a lot of the letters he received from attorneys and the receiver and the management company and everybody who was involved, and mailed it to me. And I have it here in my office. And after I read it, I really believe them. And it's really sad to read. And I think what is even more sad is that many people being threatened with losing their homes, their life savings, their kids' tuition, and everything they ever saved for, being left with nothing, and nobody, and I mean absolutely nobody, wants to help them. They pleaded to every government agency you can find, you can think of. They pleaded to every legislator in their neighborhood. They pleaded to legislators in Tallahassee to help them. And so far, all they got in return is letters from different government agencies telling them, we're really sorry, we're unable to help you. Homeowners Association in Florida are not regulated, and you would have to hire a private attorney to present your case. That's it. Nothing more. And, under the circumstances, I think that is absolutely sad.
You know, I'm reading, I pulled a lot of stuff from your website. And you have a number of articles. Some, I guess, were written by the homeowners themselves. Some were written by, Florida papers. I'm pulling something out here. It says in 1992, the first buildings or 24 homes began to have significant water damage. At the time the problems were identified, the developer had full control of the homeowners association. The developer ignored many requests to fix the damages, and in 1998 turned the homeowners association and the problems over to the community. Without resolution from the developer, the homeowners in the first six buildings obtained legal counsel and sued the homeowners association to fix their homes. So basically, they went to the developer and said, "Look, we've got all this water intrusion. There are problems here. You need to fix it." And for a period of 8 years, did I say? The developer just blew them off, and then he just transitioned over to the association and walked away.
That is correct. Now, and declared bankruptcy. Don't forget that part.
Oh, he declared bankruptcy. Now, Jan, Where are the inspectors? I mean, you pay your taxes, right? Where's the government?
I haven't gotten a complaint so far yet.
So where's the government with their inspectors? I mean, don't they have these codes that they're enforcing?
Well, yes, but the inspectors all had everything passed. You know, they signed off. Everything was in best order. I mean, the county now acknowledges that there may have been problems. But nevertheless, that doesn't help the people. And, you know, the big part is even that some of the people who have these construction problems got big, huge settlements from their insurance companies. But they, according to the court so far, they can keep them, in some cases, $200,000, but the neighbors have to pay for the repairs of just these homes where insurance settlements were received for. Now, in the meanwhile, after the judge, in his infinite wisdom, came up with his judgment that the neighbors have to pay for the repairs, some insurance companies stopped paying settlements which were already planned on being to be paid
to the individual homeowners.
That is the part. You know, you have an insurance, you have a private home, so you have a problem, you call your insurance should pay for it. That is why you pay an insurance, in my opinion. But no, in this case, and that is the part which more or less nobody can understand, is people got insurance settlements, but still the neighbors are asked to pay for the repairs, and these people keep the insurance settlements. I mean, this is unbelievable.
I was reading this because I downloaded all of this stuff last night, printed it up, and sat down, and I read it. And it seems to me like the biggest mess where everybody's blaming, pointing the finger at everybody else, saying it's their fault. The developer, I read, says, oh, wait a minute, I didn't do anything. You know, I built these houses properly, and it's the maintenance that the homeowners did because they power washed or they hosed or whatever, and they knocked the caulking out, and that's where the water came in. It's like everybody's pointing the fingers, and the poor homeowners who paid a ton of money for these houses are left not only stuck with, you know, terrible construction, but they're also stuck with $93,000 special assessments.
Yeah, but see, Michelle, the actual problem is not so much that there are construction problems and construction defects. That happens all the time. I mean,
that's a sad comment, you know?
Yeah, you know, but the thing is, how can a judge in his right mind come up with a decision that neighbors have to pay for other neighbors for the repair of other neighbors' property? This property, which is damaged, is private property. It is not common area. It is not common property. It's deeded to single people. So why do the neighbors have to pay for it in the first place? It makes absolutely no sense.
So basically you have homeowners who, by court order, may be losing their houses. You know what intrigues me, Jan, is the fact that there's 182 units in this development, and 120 of them, 120, two-thirds of them, risk foreclosure.
Well, which has, to my knowledge, don't ask me where this number came from. I got it from homeowners, and so did the papers. But it seems like there are about a third of the so-called villas have construction problems. Now, the others are supposed to pay for it. And as I told you before, some already walked out, which makes the burden on the other people even higher. Because, see, the less pay into this big pot, which is supposed to be created to pay for all these repairs, the share gets bigger the less people pay in. And it seems like this is going to be the case. And, you know, it didn't help that the receiver ordered every house in the whole community to be inspected. They came to houses which are totally perfect, according to the homeowners, and drilled big holes in the walls and left it like it is.
Oh, so they're adding to the problems.
Oh, yes.
They're not going to fix...
That's the way some of these homeowners see it, and so do I. Because there were no complaints from these homeowners. They didn't say, my house has leaks or my house has problems. But nevertheless, the receiver said, I have to check it all out in order to do my duty. Well, excuse me, in my personal opinion, he is looking very much at his own private bank account and not at the welfare of the people he should take care of.
Well, those are the sentiments echoed by Lara Shane, who thinks that residents are being victimized at every turn by a developer who built the shoddy homes from 1992 to 1998, by a judge who took control out of the residents' hands, by a county building department that failed to ensure homes were built to code, by a receiver who's overdoing reconstruction to protect himself against being sued, and by construction firms seeking to create more work.
Yes, and she was definitely right. And you know, the part which as well many people don't understand is, you know, this judgment came from a circuit court judge.
Okay.
Now, the circuit court judge ordered a receiver. He ordered that everybody has to pay. He ordered everything. By the way, it's a part-time judge who most of the time lives out of the state and is hard to reach. But normally, any judgment before it is the things are done which the judgment says, everybody waits for the decision of the appeals court. This case is pending in appeals court. So it's not a final decision yet. But nevertheless, the people are asked to pay and are more or less already forced to pay. What happens if the appeals court says the judgment was incorrect? And
then where do you go?
Yeah, and reverses the decision. Who is then paying for all the money which has been spent in the meanwhile?
It's been collected?
Oh, yes.
And
I mean, you know that these people pay $28,000. Multiply that by 128. That's a lot of money.
You said that a third of the homes are having problems.
Yes.
Correct?
That's
and yet two-thirds...
what I was told, and that's how it reads in the document, yes.
And yet two-thirds of the homes are risk being foreclosed on. And Jan, there's something really funny with all of this.
The thing is, it is not really funny. I'm sorry.
No, I don't mean funny humorous. I mean, you've got 180 homes, and from what I've read here, the cost was between $125,000 and $240,000, which is basically what people paid for them. One-third of those, so about 60 of them are having problems, yet 120 of them risk being foreclosed on. When I say funny, I mean it just doesn't add up somehow.
No, the whole honestly, the whole thing doesn't add up. But nobody really wants to talk about it, and nobody wants to get into the detail.
Who's nobody? The homeowners.
There have been cases, and I heard recently that people were threatened with lawsuits for just wanting to say what is true.
You mean there's a sort of a gag order or threatened?
No, there's no official gag order, but funny enough, some of the people who wanted to speak out suddenly shut up. Some with explanation of court orders or papers served by an attorney in one case, but other people just said, hey, I don't want to deal with it anymore and I don't say anything anymore. So you can imagine what happened then.
So basically it's, oh boy, that's terrible. Jan, I hate to say this, but we're out of time.
I know that, and
I want to thank you for coming on.
And it was fun being with you, and I hope some people just take notion and realize what they're getting into if they're moving into homeowners association.
And stay away from fraud-friendly Florida, huh?
Yes, please.
Can you say that three times?
We have to deal with it.
But this is probably one of the more horrible stories that I've heard. $93,000 in special assessments is absolutely the highest, in my knowledge, of any that I've heard of anywhere. I wish you luck.
So far, but there was another case in South Florida, which a federal court just repealed, and so they got away and don't have to pay, I think, a judgment of more than $5 million.
Wow.
Wow.
Thank you so much, Jan. Keep up the good work. I know that you put in a lot of hours, and you do a bang-up job. Check out his website, ccfj.net. It's a wealth of information over there. And thanks for tuning in to On the Commons. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions. Stay tuned, because...